From Calvary Church of Santa Ana, this is the Calvary Life Podcast, the show where we share stories, tell jokes, and have discussions about faith, life, and God with people from Calvary Church. Here are your hosts, Eric and Matt.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Calvary Life Podcast. We are so happy that you are listening. This is actually our first episode that we are on the road. Right, Matt?
On the road. Yes, we've traveled. We are deep somewhere in the Malibu Canyons off the Malibu Beach on a missions retreat right now.
That's right. We are with a group of our missionaries. I'm Eric Wakeling here with you. We're, again, just happy that you're listening, and we hope that you would also rate and review the Calvary Life Podcast, because really that's how more people will find out about it, and we hope that these stories can be an encouragement to people. So thanks for doing that. But we are excited to have a few episodes with some of our missionaries.
Yeah, and we happen to be sitting here in a room with a man known as Shell Aronson. Shell, will you say hi?
Hi, everybody. I am Shell Aronson from Kenya.
And so we just came from Orange County, but you have come and you've traveled many, many miles. So give us just a little background on your story, who you are, your association with Calvary, all of that really fun stuff.
My parents worked with Africa Inland Mission in Tanganyika back in the 40s, and they were sent out by Calvary Church, some of their early missionaries. So we've had a long relationship. I was born in a country that no longer exists, a place called Tanganyika Territory.
Yeah, wait a minute. Where is that? I don't even know about Tanganyika.
Tanganyika was the name for what's currently Tanzania when it was a British mandated territory. It used to be called German East Africa.
Wow.
So my birth certificate says Shinyanga Territory, Tanganyika Territory, but no longer exists.
So what was growing up there like? What was that like?
We grew up on a peninsula on the edge of Lake Victoria. My dad was doing church planting in a new area. We thought it was great. We lived in tents. Our bathtub was the lake itself. We got to go swimming every evening. That was how we got our baths. It's also how I got Bilharzia, but I did survive. But I lived there for about 4 years, and then my parents were transferred to Kenya. So most of my memories are from Kenya, growing up in the country of Kenya.
Okay, so what's Bilharzia? What does that do to you?
It's a nasty disease, tropical disease called cystosomiasis. It actually comes from a snail, and some little parasite in the snail gets in your intestines. And if you don't get treated, it kind of riddles your holes in your gut.
Oh man.
See, this is what it, like, we've talked to missionaries, and this is what people don't really understand. Like, when we get to hang out with you just for a little bit, just enough extended time, like every story starts out like this. This is nothing like,
right.
I was born in Compton, and there's just in the city, but like never. Yeah.
But we're about 3 minutes in, and I've learned about country names I didn't know and diseases I had no idea about. So that's a good start.
So your birth certificate, passport, like all, do you have to get new ones with all of those things? Did you save the old ones? Like, what's your history, like your wardrobe tank of memories from your childhood look like?
I still carry that old birth certificate.
Yeah.
My current passport just says I was born in Tanzania, which is the current name of the independent country. So, yeah.
Wow. Over the years, you see your parents, they're doing missions work and they're called. Do you have a sense growing up that that's the direction your life is going to take?
When I grew up, I loved playing sports, went through high school in Rift Valley Academy in Kenya.
Oh, yeah.
And I really wanted to go back to Africa, but when I was going to college here at Westmont in Santa Barbara on a soccer scholarship, all I could say was, I want to go back to Africa, but I don't want to be a missionary. I don't want to have to raise support. That was my idea. Then partway through college, I went back for 6 months sort of as a vision trip. I was tired of living in California. I was homesick. So 1976, I went back to Kenya, volunteered for about 6 months, did some teaching. I thought I might want to be a teacher. I didn't really like that, but I watched my dad, who was part of a literature ministry, and helped him write some stories and do some interviews, and worked in his darkroom when we were actually make pictures with black and white and darkroom and developer and all that kind of stuff. And when I came back, I had this real sense that I could really make a difference on the mission field as a Christian journalist.
Wow, that's very interesting. Now, didn't you also, though, maybe you met a girl while you were at Westmont?
I did. I hadn't met her yet. I came back to Westmont after that that bit of time.
We need the timeline.
Yeah. So end of summer of 76, I came back from Kenya from that bit of time.
Okay.
Really keen to do some studies in journalism. I met my wife, Kim, at that juncture. Met her at Westmont. And after a bit of time there, we decided we would get married, and we moved up to Portland for a while, finished my studies at Multnomah Bible College because they had a biblical studies major as well as a class in Christian journalism. So that's what I did.
Okay. Now, does Kim, okay, when you meet, you come back from your 6 months, you meet Kim, does she already share a heart of for missions, or are you having to like wonder when do you reveal this that you want to live in Kenya?
Yeah, she didn't have a particular call to missions. She'd grown up in a family that was not believers until she was late high school. But she was really a committed, passionate believer. In fact, she said, I don't know if you're even a Christian. You never say praise the Lord all the time. You just sort of talk about God. You don't talk about Jesus. And I said, well, isn't God Jesus? So, because she was just on fire.
Yeah.
So I think it was more when she knew me, and I said, well, my life is probably going to be back in Africa. Mm-hmm. And I think the love that we had for each other, she just held on to that, and we'll go together.
Wow. So how does your call then progress? So you head up to the Portland area, and right? And so then how does this then culminate to you guys going over?
Right. The years that we were at Multnomah, we were studying to finish those courses in Bible and in journalism so we could go back to Africa, work with my parents in this Keisha Publications ministry. And we were accepted by AIM, the mission that my parents were with, to go out and work there. And everything seemed to be moving towards that, and we were starting to raise support. And then we got a letter from the mission saying, we're not sure who told you there was work in Africa as a journalist with our mission, but we don't have any job assignments for anybody of that kind. And it was really a heart-searching time for me. It was as if God was saying, are you willing to stay in America? It's not the opposite of, you know, oh, God, don't send me to Africa. Mine was, God, don't make me stay in America.
Wow, yeah.
But I literally, with a time of prayer with my wife, and just said, you know, if God has closed this door to Africa, we have to be willing to serve God where he's called us. And God seemed to be saying, if you're really willing to do that, show me. Hmm. So I actually went down to Tillamook, Oregon. I did an interview at the Tillamook Herald, which is a tiny weekly newspaper, pretty much guaranteed that I would get the job, and went back to Portland going, I guess we're going to be Tillamook people.
And this is the home of the cheese, right?
The home of the cheese. Okay. Yeah, it would have been great. I could have reported on cheese and cows the rest of my life.
It's a metropolis for cheese. That's good.
Yeah. But when we got back to Portland that very evening, this is before emails and stuff, there was a letter in our little post box, and it says, somebody made a mistake. There is a job description. We really want you to come to Kenya as a journalist with AIM. Please do everything you can to keep on your journey to get here as fast as possible. So, but it was like God had to take me to the point where I literally was willing to give up that dream of Africa. Mm. And then it seemed it wasn't me trying just to go home to be where I was comfortable, but rather it was God saying, yes, this is what I have for you. I do want you to go to Kenya.
This is not the first, like, or the only surprise that you've had as a missionary. Just looking back over these kind of twists and turns, like, what does that tell you about God and your relationship with him? Have there been other circumstances where you thought you were going one way and then all of a sudden things change? And what is God up to? And what have you learned in those experiences?
We've learned to trust whatever God is showing us. That was the main twist and turn. After that, we did end up in Kenya where we expected to be. Hmm. But the other thing, when we got there right away, the mission and the church say, well, you can't stay in this job forever. Everything has to be nationalized. You have to turn everything over to a Kenyan as fast as possible. Hmm. It took us 10, 12 years, but it really did change my focus. Instead of saying, let me just build a media empire. I mean, we published books. We had a Christian magazine where we focused on issues that really concern the youth of Kenya, how Christians should take their faith into the field of the problems that they're facing, everything from how to grow up if your parents are polygamous, how do you honor your mother if she's not your mother, if she's only your stepmother. I mean, all these different kind of things. But towards the end of that, it was certain that we had taken on 3 or 4 young men, sent them on to some communication schools, and I did a lot of training. We're writers' workshops across East Africa, getting freelance writers. And by the early 90s, it was very clear that we were able to turn this back over to the African church, to the national church. And then my question was, well, now what? Do we just go back to America and try and get a job at the Oregonian? Or do I, what do we do? Huh. So that was another big juncture and a time of stopping, praying, and asking God, what is the next step?
Hmm. Now, do you think that's the... Is that the key, or what, if there's other people listening that aren't, maybe they're not considering Africa or, you know, the Oregonian, but they're considering whatever it is in their life. What's the way to seek God? What's the way to find the insight for that?
Yeah. We've learned that it's very important just to stop, to take time and to listen. Both my wife and I have been able to take these times. When it looks like a big transition, a big juncture in the life ahead of us. And we will actually move out of the house for a while, find a place in the forest and just sit, listen. And sometimes God speaks in a small voice. Sometimes we talk to each other and both feel that we are on the same page with a particular change. And other times we hear nothing at all.
yeah, exactly.
So we just put it off for a while and ask again, and sometimes circumstances come together. But it's we just try and put God first in making those kind of decisions, especially when a big change is due.
Doesn't it seem like, at least for me, the time when I mostly hear nothing at all is if I don't ever stop, right? Yeah. It's like if I just keep going busy,
right?
I'm almost, I mean, we can be interrupted by God for sure. And I believe in that. But at the same time, that's when, at least I think I'm not hearing from God, as if I'm not listening. And it, I mean, it seems to make sense, right? If all you do is talk.
Hamster on the wheel, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely has to be a sense when you pull back and just be quiet, turn off the noise.
Yeah.
And it takes time. It does take time. We just did something today here at our retreat. We had half an hour of solitude, and I was just only sort of getting to the quiet it down and time's up, I have to go back.
We felt the same way.
Yeah, felt the same way. Yeah, I typically need more of like a half a day just to get there, just to get to the beginning.
Yeah. You've been a missionary, really, and serving in this way for how long now?
We've been with AIM for 38 years.
38 years. So I'm just curious, what's changed? From when you started and you got even just the letter in the mail versus a text message you're in or something like that, right? But what else has changed on the landscape for those who are just entering into missionary service?
Right. Communications is an obvious one. Right. We would go, that airmail letter would take 3 weeks to come back to your parents. We would make one phone call a year and it would cost us $100 and you barely could hear over the scratchy phones. Wow. Now, between email, Skype, everything else, we're in touch with the world. So that's been good.
Instantly.
Yeah. So that has made it in some ways easier to be in touch with family, especially because one of the hard things I think in the early days was being away from family. I remember watching my mom one day. She got a letter in the mail. I was probably sixth grade, and she just started to cry. And she says, I said, what happened? He says, my mom died, but she died 3 weeks ago and they've already had the funeral and I've only just now heard about it, you know?
Wow.
And I mean, I was an impressionable young kid. Oh, grandma's dead. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know her that well. I'd met her twice in my life. But you realize the sacrifices that our parents went through, and we don't have to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's really changed, I think, in missions is a real focus that the missionaries that go out, the say North American, European, expat type missionaries going to a country or a continent like Africa are that no longer what we used to call the general missionaries who went out and did everything. The church has really matured in these areas. Mm-hmm. There are lots of people doing the maintenance level type work that every church needs. And missions, at least our mission, has become much more a focus on trying to get into the unreached areas. So actually moving into the hard areas, finding ways to share what we believe about Jesus Christ into people groups who have not yet had a chance to hear. So it's not so much more specialized, but it's not nearly in the old days you had what you call general missionaries, and they went out and they helped to run a clinic and they kept the finances and they did everything for this whole mission station. But now almost all that is done by competent and educated Kenyans where we are.
That's cool.
So it allows us to sort of be focusing on places even the Kenyans may not want to go. We've got some forested areas where we've gone to reach out to the Dorobo people.
Yeah, that's what I want to hear about, the Dorobo people.
A lot of them are places where they were left out because not even the Kenyans wanted to go back in those places because they're hard to get to.
So talk about them. Yeah, talk about the Dorobo people. What are they like?
How do you get there?
What's their life like? Yeah, what area are you talking about even in Kenya?
Yeah. Well, when we were turning over the magazine ministry to our national writers and editors, and praying for God to show us in that quiet time that we had, there was a sense that we should look into reaching out to a group called the Dorobo. Our mission had identified four or five unreached groups in Kenya, and they said, we want to pray until somebody is engaging these groups, telling them about the gospel. So I looked at that list, and I saw Dorobo, and I really felt a pull. I've always been a history buff, love East African history, and the early explorers, the early hunters, always would talk about having a Dorobo hunter who would show them the way, who would track the elephants through the forest. And I just said to myself, are there still Dorobo hunters alive and well?
Right, it's like mythical, right?
They're sort of these mythical guys who sort of show up out of the forest. And so we actually asked AIM if we could be the point people to do this ministry. And they said, sure, go ahead. Wow. So as I was turning over the magazine, I would disappear for a week or two and start trying to find where the Dorobo people live.
Let's break that down. What does that mean? When I'm going to run out for a couple of weeks and try and find, are you driving? Are you walking? Yeah. Are you riding sort of animal?
Right. Are you looking at a parchment? Like, I think there's a parchment, go to the wild rock and you'll see a goat, and the goat will give you this message what does that look like? Right.
We looked around, we prayed, we weren't sure where to start. One of our missionary doctors said, when I do a medical clinic, a mobile clinic in Narok County, there's always one or two people come and they identify themselves as Dorobo. So come with me on this clinic.
Yeah.
Step one was to say, okay, we'll go with Dr. Bransford. We will go to this clinic and see if we can find any Dorobo. So we went with him on this clinic, went with our family, camped overnight. We went by Land Rover. We got stuck in the mud.
Okay. Wow.
Finally set up the clinic, and then nobody showed up except for Maasai people. Okay. So my wife and I said, all right, well, let's start asking around. And so we started hiking into the forest because it's a thick forest, old Pusimoru forest area. And as we were hiking along, we met a Maasai, and we says, we're looking for some Dorobo people. And he just laughed. He says, if you want, you'll never find them. He says, the Dorobo are like ghosts. They hide in the forest. They're just hunters. And if they don't want you to find them, you'll never find them. Their dogs don't bark. Their kids don't cry. So I said, oh, okay.
We could learn some things from them, actually.
Yeah. How do they get their kids to cry? They could write a book and make millions.
So we spent a whole day looking and were defeated. But that evening, as we came back to the clinic to the doctor, he said, oh, here's these two ladies. They came in the end of the day. They are Dorobo. So we talked to them. And they said, oh, we are Dorobo, and here's where to go. And they actually gave us some directions. So the next morning we got up and we followed their directions and drove to the end of the road, got out of the car, and came around and found this house with a grass roof. And the dog barked at us.
Oh.
And then two little kids came out and they cried. So we said to ourselves, this can't be a Dorobo household because the kids are crying and the dogs are barking. But the man came out, and believe it or not, he was a Dorobo and he was a believer. Well, he said he and his wife were the only two believers that he knew of in that whole area. He'd been to school. He'd been hired by an American anthropologist, Rod Blackburn, to be his language helper. Mm-hmm. And so he basically sat down with us and gave us a map. He wrote a map like this is your treasure map.
Yeah.
And he says there are Dorobo people on this area of the Pusimoro Forest. There's ones over here at Narakingari. There's ones here at Anose. You can follow over to Tololorton. You go over from there to Ebudu. You go from there. And he had them all listed out.
Wow.
So he gave it to us and told us to go ahead. We started the church at his place. His place was called Ngareta. We sent his younger brother to Bible college, and there's still a thriving Dorobo church where he was. And then we visited, like I say, every couple of weeks I would disappear from my editorial office in my car, and we would drive up to these.
It's like you take the suit off and you're putting the Indiana Jones gear on, right? Yeah. And that's I love it.
It is very much Clark Kent, actually, and Superman, because, journalists and all that, right? Oh,
that's right. That's a better story. Thank you.
That's all right.
That's why there's two of us here.
And, No.
But on one of the early trips, they'd sent me, this one village said, we don't want you to come to us, but we have brothers who live on top of Oldonio Puru, a volcanic mountain. We just go over there. So I got the map and follow. Oh yeah, there's people there. So when I showed up there, I found two ladies and I start talking to them and start saying, I'm a missionary and we're interested in telling people about God's word. Are there anybody here who might be interested? And before they could answer, I felt these creepy feeling on my leg and I looked down and I had all these black pinching ants crawling up my legs. So I had to jump behind my car. I had to strip off very quickly and pull. There's the only way to get rid of pinching ants is to see them against your white flesh and pull them off before they bite anything vital. And these ladies are on the other side of the car just laughing their heads off that this white guy stepped in the pinching ants and didn't notice it till they were already crawling up his legs. But when I finally was dressed again and able to go around and talk to them, they basically said that they were very interested in learning more about God. They'd been trying to attend some local churches. One was a Catholic church, one was an Anglican church, but they both used Kikuyu language. They didn't understand the language very well, but they had a heart for knowing more. They didn't know anything beyond the fact that they wanted to know more about God and what the church had to offer. So that then became one of our points of what we call a preaching point, a place where we went to regularly. Within the couple years after that, we'd go there once or twice a month and we'd start telling stories.
Now, if you're listening to this, you have to press pause and like go back 10 minutes and just listen to everything that you just said. Was, I think we need to put like a glossary of all the different terms and the forests and everything else that you did. But like, I think when I'm looking for things, like I'm like, where's the best taco shop? And if I can't find it on the first try, we'll just let go. But you are going into these areas, you're asking questions. You have to have a little bit of a sense of adventure. I'm also wondering, is there a sense of fear? We hear the Jim Elliot stories, and we even modern day, you go to an island and there's pirates there and you don't go there. Was there any fear? Were there any rumors about the Jorobo people that were, hey, we're maybe going too far, we're pushing a little too much, or did you just go for it? Does that not even register for you?
There was a bit of fear, but it was more of a fear that I'm a journalist, I can speak Swahili, but do I even know how to share my story in a way that these people are going to understand? There was a sense that, yes, I'm on the edge of these forests, on the edge of the road. First time I felt fear with one of these guys is I really wanted to sort of understand their culture. Now, they are, by tradition, they hunt with poison arrows. They do collect honey in the forest. So I asked this one man, I said, to Kosen, I said, can I help you harvest some honey? He says, why would you want to do that? You'll get stung. I said, well, I'd really want to. He says, you can't. You have to leave really early in the morning. I said, well, I could do that. Well, the only way you could do that is come stay at my house. You would stay at my house? Yeah, I'll come stay at your house. And so we went out, stayed at his house, got up 4:35 in the morning and went out into the forest.
Are you sleeping on a bed, on the floor?
I slept on a bed, but I think half of his children also shared the same bed once I fell asleep. So I woke up kind of surrounded by little kids. So. yes, it was in his house.
Yeah.
And it was a very small, tiny house. I think that was the only bed in the house. But yes, the morning we got up and we went into the forest and, immediately we heard this big crashing in the bush and this Kosen friend of mine, he says, oh, don't worry. Those are buffalo. He says, I'll just tell them that there is a Jorobo hunter in the forest so they don't bother us. And he just screamed really loudly. And of course there's more crashing in the bushes, but he had no spear. He had no bow and arrow. He had nothing, no gun, nothing. And these animals are known to trample people.
Yeah.
So I sort of took a deep breath and he said, don't worry. He says, well, I've told the buffalo there's a Jorobo in the forest. They're not going to bother us. And we hiked off and harvested our honey. I did get stung by the bees though.
Did that earn respect somehow though, you think?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I was willing to go with him.
Yeah.
He said that one of the ways that they hunt, there's thick bamboo forest up there. He said what they will often do is they'll take two hunters and they climb up these bamboo. It gets quite big so they can get way to the top. But when you're at the top, then the bamboo kind of closes like this.
Yeah.
And then there's a path underneath. And the guys with the dogs come and chase the buffalo. The buffalo run down this path and they spear it from above. And then they said, but we're never going to take you on a buffalo hunt because you're too big and you'll fall down and you'll get killed. So I've never been on a buffalo hunt with a Jorobo. I've been on a bush buck hunt, but not a buffalo hunt.
What does that mean? A bush buck hunt.
A bush buck is a different kind of animal.
It's an animal.
It's like a deer.
Like a deer, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
And we each went out. Every one of us had a club. One guy had a what they call a ponga, big machete type thing, and a bunch of dogs. And they scared it up with the dogs. And then the bush buck actually ran up our path. They had us up blocking all the game paths coming up from this ravine. And this one went right at us. And me and my friend Julius just held our clubs and threatened like this with, you know. And the bush buck turned around and then ran into the dogs. The dogs flipped it over, and then they quickly attacked it with the machete. And within half an hour, we had not only killed it, but butchered it and sent it home and eating bush bucks too.
There you go.
So
we had a very similar experience. Remember when we climbed Mount Arbel in Israel that one year, and there was seven cows in the way?
Yes.
And we looked at each other and said, what are we going to do now?
Yeah.
And thank God there was a guy from Nebraska, and he just started yelling at the cows and they all moved. But that's about as close as I've ever got to that experience.
Exactly like the buffalo. Yeah.
Man, oh man.
And the bush buck.
Man, oh man. That's amazing.
Now, did the Drobo people... So you had to learn their language, or did they also speak a shared language that you could know? How's the Bible then work in their language and with what you do? Do you partner with other people? How's that all then come into play?
I speak Swahili, and they already, most of the men spoke Swahili. The ladies did not. The area that we were in, the Drobo speak Maasai because they live next to a larger, more dominant group called the Maasai pastoralists. Mm-hmm. So we did learn Maasai, and so when we started sharing the stories from the Bible, we used Maasai haltingly and then did deeper explanations in Swahili.
In Swahili, okay.
So, and sometimes we had a few men who were really good in both languages, and they would sometimes step in and do a bit more interpretation for us.
But when you're going to a new people group and... language is not the barrier where you're having to learn and all the linguistic stuff that goes along with that. That's like we just saved ourselves 5 years, right? And that's a blessing, right? And all of that.
Yeah. That's the good thing about most of East Africa has Kiswahili as a lingua franca, a trade language. Most people can get along in that. It's not their heart language. They really appreciate it. If you learn Maasai and can speak in that, but you can still communicate with Swahili. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. Let's see. So other question I have for you. People can't see you, but you are right now wearing a Rift Valley Academy jersey. Now, this is Rift Valley Academy is a missionary school, missionary kids school, right? And is that a rugby jersey that you're wearing?
It is a rugby jersey. Rift Valley Academy was started as a school for missionary kids about 1906, actually. Specifically so that missionaries from overseas wouldn't have to send their kids back to America for 8-9 years at a time.
Yeah.
So it was quite a revolutionary concept to actually have a missionary kids school on site in Africa. I went to school there from the early 60s on. My earliest memories were watching a South African coach introduce rugby to the school when I was in first grade. So I've always thought rugby was this great sport. So yeah. I played rugby there, then I coached rugby there. And then a few years ago, I actually sponsored these shirts to the school, paid for them, and bought one myself. So, yeah, that's why I've got the logo on there.
Now, that looks good. Now, I have to ask a question because we have a lot of our young people and even adults who went to Hume Lake for camp, and now they're fully grown. There is a game that they play at Hume Lake called Kajabi Can Can. Now, what the city or the place that Rift Valley Academy in is called Kajabi, Kenya, right? So do you know I haven't done any pre-work on this question, so I don't know what I'm going to get.
It could go nowhere, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
But do you know the origins of Kajabi Can Can, this game?
I think I do.
Okay.
Oh, this is so good.
Yes.
All right.
We used to play it regularly at Kajabi. It was part of Friday night, what they call rowdy games. You actually got to hold hands with some girl around a circle because you're holding your hands around this cone of glasses that stood up about 8 feet tall, and then you pulled yourself around it.
Glasses, like drinking glasses.
Drinking glasses all stacked up.
And they were lit on fire? Or
they didn't have to be lit on fire.
Okay, just checking.
You made a big circle around it, and everybody held hands, and then you just began pulling. And whoever knocked it over, touched it with their stomach and knocked it over, it got out, and the circle got smaller and smaller.
Okay.
We just called it red hot poker. You're trying not to touch the thing in the middle.
Okay.
My older brother, John... came back to California in the 60s, went to Westmont, and there was a period of time when he did youth ministry at Calvary Church.
Uh-huh.
And we're thinking, this is what all I can think is, because he he said he played that game with the kids at Calvary Church in youth ministry type stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of Calvary kids go to Hume Lake. So over time, I think he said, because he was a Kajabi boy, and he always talked about being from Kajabi, that, and because you either stand up cans or glasses or whatever, that Kajabi can grew out of what we used to just call red hot poker. But I think my brother John is responsible. Yes.
Are you kidding me?
Yes. Calvary missionaries, Calvary Church is responsible for Kajabi can.
Stop the podcast.
This thing's huge. I don't know if you know that at Hume Lake now. I mean, it is. There's. It's a ongoing tournament throughout the week that builds into this huge finals night where there's a 1,000 kids gathered around this one. And now they use a trash can, and then you hold little ropes because, you know, you can't hold hands.
Oh, is that right?
No, but that's part. Exactly.
A little better leverage or something like that. Okay. Maybe they need to bring it back. But it's guys and guys. Guys are playing with guys, girls playing with girls.
And it is, I mean, there's like acrobatics, it feels like people flying over the can to not
broken
touch
arms
it
and everything else.
Oh yeah,
absolutely. But we can be proud that the roots of Kajabi can come from Rift Valley
from
Academy.
The little mission station called Kajabi. Yes, it's actually a big mission station. Good. Yeah, good.
That was worth the price of admission. Thank you. I have a question. Looking at you have a very rich history and relationship with Calvary as a missionary. And not just you, but your family. It goes back to the beginning. And I've been grafted into this Calvary family for the last 20 years. And we have this heritage that we've kind of inherited, that we are a missions church. Global missions is a really big part. And what I think that both Eric and I and everyone who's part of this family here is we've just learned that Calvary is known, even just worldwide, for being this amazing missions church. I'm just curious, what does that viewpoint look like from where you sit? And then how did that get there? And what's the beauty and benefit? What do you get from that relationship with the Calvary family?
We, as kids growing up, we knew that when we came back to the States, my parents would always make a trip down to Calvary Church. And I was a little kid, I remember coming here. It's always scary to go into a new Sunday school class with everything else. But my parents always said, this is a church. They'd been part of it when they were at Biola years ago, and this church really believed in missions. They prayed for missions really got behind their missionaries. So from that early age, we just knew that Calvary was a place that really supported. And it's been a big, big supporter to us. When we first went out as missionaries, my wife and I had a hard time raising support at the beginning because I had grown up in Africa. And what was my home church? Well, I really didn't have one, but I knew Calvary and I'd been here occasionally. So we did show up here one day and eventually they said, oh, well, I guess we should probably support the children of our missionaries. And so, so they ended up getting behind us as well. But as we're out there on the field, we know that we can send back requests. There are smaller groups, ladies groups, especially Women with a Mission is one, and they're continually getting on us. Once something new? You haven't sent us anything new for a month, so it keeps us on the on
wonderfully
our feet.
Wonderfully so, pushy, right?
Yeah, no, it's very good.
Yeah.
And then what impressed me as an adult missionary was the first time we came to a missions conference. I mean, you know, they support other missionaries. But we'd sort of gone through the process of being chosen just one at a time. And we met the missions committee and we went out. We knew my parents were supported and some of my brothers. Mm-hmm. But to come back and suddenly come to one of these missions conferences and suddenly sit together with 20, 30 other couples and say, wow, this is amazing. And this is all the things that God is doing through a church that's been faithful for a long time. So that's good.
Yeah. That's love amazing. It. Yeah. So we just want you to know we are super grateful for you, Shell and Kim and your extended family and all your, you know, and all your brothers, and just excited about what God's doing you. What if people want to know more, how can they find out more about what you're doing with the Jarobo people or even the journalism stuff and with Africa Inland Mission?
Yes, they can get in touch with, I think if you just Googled Africa Inland Mission, amint.us, something like that, or Calvary Missions Department. They've got all of our contacts there. So those are the two best places, I think, to get in touch with us.
That's great. Well, we'd love for people to find out more and see how they can support you and everything you're doing. So thank you for sharing with us, Shell.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks again for joining us on the Calvary Life Podcast. If you enjoyed our show this week, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. If you want to learn more about Calvary Church or share any of your thoughts, check us out on our website at calvarylife.org or find us on one of our social media accounts. We're on Instagram at @Calvary_Church, Facebook at Calvary Church of Santa Ana, and Twitter at @CalvaryLife.